If you grew up in the Plymouth Brethren Church or the Church of Christ, the non-instrumental Church of Christ, you must have felt very much at home with the two anthems we sang without the accompaniment of what those two churches would call the infernal contraptions known as instruments of music. Only the vocal cords. Lorna, feel free this morning to stand proudly with these two when they are welcomed. All right? I had hoped to be the only minister in America who would refuse to mention what day it is. But one of my maverick choir members, I noticed, brought a sign this morning and showed it to me, and so I will show it to you. It says, "Go Steelers." Some of you, I presume, are in agreement. I've been trying to forget it. In fact, I hoped that the strong south wind would blow the entire excessively hyped thing up into Canada. It has been quite a while since I have done what is called expository preaching from the New Testament. So last Sunday, I announced that for a few weeks, we would consider some themes from the Apostle Paul's letter to the church at Rome. The verses I have chosen for this morning have no particular link with one another, so the sermon is entitled simply, "A Potpourri from Paul." I hope you don't all feel, as one of my dearest friends felt this morning, when he said, "Do you mean to tell me that I have driven all the way from Perry, Kansas, to hear a potpourri from Paul?" You listen carefully, Jack Galbraith. You may need this. As sermons go, it's meat and potatoes rather than lemon meringue pie, so I remind you that there are always two parts to any successful sermon. The first belongs to the speaker, who must have given thought to whether what he plans to say will have some useful meaning for his audience. And the second belongs to the listeners, who give up the pleasures of daydreaming and focus sharply on what is said. In other words, I cannot hope to be helpful unless right now your minds are so fully engaged that you will make sense of Paul's words, even if I fail to do him justice. Let's begin with his remark about people who are, as the Phillips translation has it, one mass of envy. We don't rate envy as a particularly serious personality disorder, but the medieval church called it one of the seven deadly sins, always fatal to the happiness of anyone who is sick with it. Envy, that gut-wrenching resentment we feel when someone else has what we want. It has a double sting. Not only does it make us miserable over what we don't have, but it destroys our happiness with what we do have. If I admit that this ugly virus has infected my life in certain times I would prefer to forget, can you join me in a similar confession and listen with unusual self-interest for a moment? If I could pick the course content of seminary training for ministers, every one of them would be deeply exposed to two great literary masterpieces: Milton's English poem, Paradise Lost, with its incredible treasury of religious information, and Dante's Italian poem called The Divine Comedy, with its incomparable description of an imaginary journey through hell, purgatory, and paradise. In that latter poem, as he makes his spiraling way up the mountain of purgatory, Dante encounters the spirits of people who sinned on earth and are now bowed beneath burdens which are symbolic of the sin from which they are being cleansed. When he meets the envious, he sees again what our character failures would look like if they were given an actual physical form. Their eyelids are sewn together to symbolize the fact that envy blinds us to mutuality and brotherhood, locks us into the dark poverty of our own meager resources. The envious eye that once found only food for bitterness in all sights of beauty and joy must now in penance refrain from drinking in the gladness of sea and sky and human love. Unwilling in life to enjoy the good looks, the charm, the heroism or success of someone else, the envious are now forced to live in the darkness that once filled their hearts. Now, I know that such pronouncements are dangerous, but it does seem to me that more of us contract this disease than used to be the case. For one thing, we know so much more about what others have. We vacation where we could never afford to live, gazing in disbelief at beach mountain mansions and splendid yachts and $10 million homes, and suddenly we feel cheated. Modern advertising is dedicated much of the time to reminding us that we should covet what we do not have. Your 86 Chevy looks like a loser beside the sleek Lexus with the beautifully extravagant woman smiling happily from the passenger side. Want to make other women's eyes turn green with envy? The ad asks, then buy a fur coat from somewhere. Watch an evening of television and keep a running tally of the ads that appeal overtly to envy, the dissatisfaction, and you begin to understand some of the malaise we create in American life. Once the bug bites, a cure is not easy. A wise gentleman by the name of Francis Bacon wrote once long ago what strikes me as a marvelously pithy and profound four-word sentence: envy has no holidays. You think about it for a moment. Temper, lust, lies, slander, these all tend to be occasional things. But envy has a way of settling in, eating its bitter food day after day, no spring break, no vacation, Envy never gets a holiday. I said that a cure was not easy, but I think a cure is possible. Each morning, before the business of your day begins, you pause for a moment of what some will call reflection and others a prayer. I consider them close kin. And you say something like this: today I shall be among people who are less capable than I am. Help me not to take advantage of them or to exult in my superiority. But I shall also be among people who in certain ways are stronger and better than I am. Help me not to envy them, to poison myself with resentment, but to be content and to do what I can as well as I can, at peace with myself. That may be hard to remember and harder yet to say, but it would save us from envy. And believe me, there's more of that in most of us than we like to admit. If you want to know how true that is, ask yourself, when you're putting someone down, crudely or cleverly, am I doing this simply because I am jealous? And it will be surprising how often the honest answer is yes. Now, since we're hurting, let's give ourselves a little more pain, warning us in another place against hasty judgments. Paul says, in judging another, you condemn yourselves. It's a generalization, of course. It's not always true. But it's true so often that we have to think about it for a moment. The most common judgments we make are about other people's moral failures. And we condemn ourselves by conveniently forgetting our own. Judgments are invariably tempered when you first pause to ask, and how about me? What are my faults? And how do I excuse them? When we face how kindly we treat our own failures, then we grow kinder in our criticism of others. Now, besides moral judgments, we also make other kinds out of arrogance or ignorance, which leave us looking foolish. Like that critic in Blackwood's magazine long ago who wrote a scathing review of the poetry of John Keats, who had been a doctor's assistant, a kind of pharmacist, a commoner rather than an aristocrat, and only aristocrats were to write poetry. Go back to the shop, Mr. John Keats, the critic wrote. Back to the plasters, pills, and ointment boxes. The critic saw no hint of genius in John Keats. And in that failure, he passed judgment upon himself. I read the other day a judgment made in 1840 before the U.S. Senate by our own Daniel Webster about the insanity of expecting anything good to come from the wild desert west coast of America. I'm quoting now. What do we want with this region of savages and wild beasts, of deserts, of shifting sands and whirlwinds of dust, of cactus and prairie dogs. What could we do with this 3,000 miles of Pacific coast, rockbound, cheerless, and uninviting? California, Oregon, and Washington, all lumped together as useless in the future of the United States. Paul's advice about judgment is homely stuff, but it's still true. Proceed with caution. Paul gets better as he goes in this epistle, and by the middle of it, he writes out of deep personal anguish about another perennial problem. I often find, he says, that I have the will to do good, but not the power. I fail to do the good things I want to do, and the bad things I don't want to do, I find I am forever doing. Is there anyone in this room who hasn't felt that way at times? H.G. Wells said of one of his fictional characters, Mr. Polly, that he was, quote, a walking civil war. In some ways, aren't we all? We know from our parents, if we're lucky, from school, from church, from books, how to live well with ourselves and with others, and we'd like to do it, except that with Paul, we have the will to do good, but not always the power. I used to have students in a Victorian literature class read the essays of an extraordinarily brilliant man named John Stuart Mill. It's fascinating to hear him describe the superbly disciplined education his demanding father gave him, and how, as a young man, he lacked the power to do anything with it. I had a rudder, he says, but no sail. A huge cargo of facts, but no inspiration. He knew more about directions than any young man alive. He had been given a fabulous map to a useful life, but he lacked the willpower to take the trip until he met someone else, a great English poet who provided it for him, but that's another story. Somebody wrote this lighthearted description of that lack of willpower in minor matters. I should be better, brighter, thinner, and more intelligent at dinner. I should reform and take some pains, improve my person, use my brains. There's lots that I could do about it, but will I? Honestly, I doubt it. If knowing what to do and doing it were always linked, the world would be a radically different place. I remember an eager young college friend who used to go out into the country on weekends peddling a book called How to Be a Better Farmer. We all needed money, and that was how he got his. He did surprisingly well until one Saturday evening, when he came across an old gentleman sitting in the shade of his front porch, chewing tobacco and enjoying the scenery of the hills around his farm. The college boy described his book to the relaxed farmer, and then waved his hand toward the barren fields, the broken fences, the badly run down outbuildings. Wouldn't you like to buy one of these books? It'll tell you how to improve your land, preserve your buildings, and increase your income. I guarantee that reading it will make you a better farmer. The old man took a long breath, shifted a little in his rocker, launched a missile accurately toward the spittoon, and brought the conversation to an abrupt end. "Well, now," he said, "I reckon I already know how to be a lot better farmer than I am. Most sermons, I suppose, are preached to people who already know how to be better than they are." A dear friend and colleague who preaches in a congregational church in Ohio sent me a marvelous example of knowing versus doing. One of his church members dropped by the church office and mentioned that she had just been stopped for traveling 53 miles per hour in a 35 mile per hour zone near the church. It was, she said, a humiliating and expensive experience. But what really made it unique was that she was on her way to have some copies made of a poem she had just found, which had touched and she thought inspired her. My friend asked what poem it was, and she handed him a copy. It said, "Slow me down, Lord. Ease the pounding of my heart by the quieting of my mind. Steady my harried pace with a vision of the eternal reach of time. Give me amidst the confusions of my day the calmness of the everlasting hills." And on it went. And there she was, rushing madly down a city street to get reprints of a poem about slowing down and being calm. And finally this morning, this verse from Romans, which one student of Paul calls the great forgotten text. Now, I can think of several others, like, "When you do good, be quiet about it," or, "Paying back an insult gets you nowhere," or, "Love your enemies," advice that prompts a quick case of amnesia in most of us. But this one is especially intriguing because it sets forth a test for orthodoxy. Now, that may not be very important in a congregational church, but it's terribly important in a great many churches I know. Many of us who now worship here grew up with various tests for orthodoxy. Who's in, who's out, who's right, who's wrong. You were okay if you used the right name for the church, or washed feet, or took communion weekly, or kept women in their place, or sang without a piano. You know how long this list can be. But this verse from Romans defines the essence of the Christian religion. If you do not have the Spirit of Christ, you do not belong to Him. My own childhood church had several litmus tests for orthodoxy, but this verse was not one of them. Our great defender of the faith and most honored preacher for several years would have failed this test of Paul's. He was, I genuinely regret saying, a mean-spirited man who treated his wife as if she were a beggar. But we called him great because he argued like a skillful lawyer each Sunday that we were right in our doctrine and all others were wrong. several young boys under his tutelage, I being one of them, decided to become ministers for the wrong reasons. Not because the Spirit of Christ filled and warmed his life and we coveted the same, but because dogmatic certainty has a powerful appeal during the uncertainties of adolescence, and because we all wanted to go out as he had done and engage in fierce debates with those who preached false doctrine, which I must tell you included Methodists, Baptists, Presbyterians, Congregationalists, everybody but us. Now imagine for a moment what would have happened if we had remembered this verse from Paul and made the test of faith depend on how we showed the Spirit of Christ in our treatment of others. We chose some extraordinarily loveless people at times to be our leaders, simply because they read the story of Jonah literally, upheld immersion as the only mode of baptism, found no contradictions anywhere in Holy Writ. If ethics had been the test, some of them could never have been chosen. On the other hand, if goodness had been the test, some quiet folk who were never noticed would have become deacons, elders, and ministers. If you do not have the Spirit of Christ, you do not belong to him. This is a terrifying text, really. Because it means nothing counts with God except having a Christ-like spirit. Nothing else counts. The boast of heraldry, fame, the pomp of power, the wearing of a robe or a headdress, all the salutes you get for success in the marketplace, all add up to zero when it comes to identifying those who belong to Christ. We have that judgment, in fact, in the exact words of Jesus himself. Listen. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did not we prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do mighty works in your name? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Let's translate those claims for a modern audience. That repetition of Lord, Lord can stand for worship, for ritual, readings in unison, and kneeling, which if done to the constant saying of the name of Christ, must surely mean one is accepted, right? Even if one does cheat pretty steadily through the week and neglect all sorts of people who desperately need love and compassion. And the business about prophesying, it means preaching. So if you preach powerful sermons, you must be in the kingdom, right? And casting out demons. Surely that's what the skilled counselor does nowadays. Naming and getting rid of the demons that blight personality, so that doing that surely must qualify one to be a true citizen of the kingdom, right? Wrong. Useful as all those skills may be, they are not enough. And the sad verdict may be, I never knew you. What it means, thank God, is that the test of orthodoxy is not obscure or difficult or hidden to all but the experts. It's set out in a list of perfectly clear personality traits. You can test yourself on any day of the week or right now as I read them from the apostle's pen. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Look for those when you are deciding who truly belongs to Christ and be surprised. Amen. We leave this room, Almighty God, grateful for the start of a new week. May our having worshiped together help to make it a good one. Amen.